Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spangin. On today's show... Last week's headlines about the end of the Netanyahu era, following an agreement between Yair Lapid and Naftali Bennett, may have been premature. Like the Black Knight in Monty Python, Bibi keeps insisting that it is but a scratch. Unlike that armless and harmless knight, however, Netanyahu can still land a blow or two, something that the head of the Shin Bet is all too aware of. Here with me, in the studio, to discuss the shelf life of the government before it's even been sworn in, the greatest election fraud ever, and a dose of incitement and corruption, we've got Alison Kaplan-Summer and Anshul Pfeffer. Hi guys, how's it going?
Hey Simon, how are you?
Hi up, Simon.
Excellent, thank you. Before we dive into today's episode, I want to introduce listeners to Michael Hauser-Tov, who is Haaretz's new political correspondent. Michael has had to rush off to the Knesset, but before he did, I asked him what the political agenda for the week ahead looks like. Let's have a listen. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So, at the risk of sounding like a Jewish grandparent, Michael, what's so urgent that you have to rush off to the Knesset? You can't stay and chat a while?
Look, there are a lot of press conferences today. Everyone wants to say something before the big, I don't know, event at next Wednesday or next Monday, only next week, about the government sworn. So, we will see what they will say.
Who's going to be giving up? Who are you going to go and listen to today?
Lapid and Lieberman and maybe even Bennett going to talk. I don't really know. But all the big names of the story.
I'm not going to ask you to explain the whole coalition Torah standing on one foot.
Because this is not only a one-hour podcast. We will need to have, like, I don't know, a 10-hour podcast.
Or an hour a day for the next 7 days. But tell us what we should be looking out for in the next days. Which parties and maybe which individual politicians should we be keeping an eye on?
So first of all, Yariv Levin, this is the key person for today. Because a little bit later, like, I don't know, in a few more hours, he will say... when the government sworn vote going to happen.
Yariv Levin is the Speaker of the Knesset.
The Speaker of the Knesset, exactly. And we have a question if it's going to be this Wednesday or it's going to be next Monday. Look, it's 4 days. You can say it doesn't really matter. But it is matter because, you know, all the pressure of all the Yamina party members and first of all, Ner Orbach, the MK Ner Orbach. So, of course, these 4 days are something. I don't know how big it is. I mean, I don't know if it's really matter if it's going to be this week or the next week, but yeah, Yariv Levin is the key person for today, first of all. Then, of course, Ayelet Shaked. We will have to see if something going to happen. I don't think so. I think Ayelet Shaked is full on board already, but we will see. And then, of course, Naftali Bennett, which have to keep all the party, all the Yamina party together. And he work on it every day. Every day they have like a daily meeting just to make sure that everything's fine with everyone.
And the pressure that you're talking about is pressure from Likud, from Netanyahu to break up.
Of course, Likud and Tzionut Datit and all the section of Smotrich, all the Smotrich party and the Smotrich voters, they act a lot all those days and they make a lot of pressure of all the members of Yamina party.
So those 4 extra days, although one of them would be Shabbat, in which political activity grinds to a halt.
Yes, but Shabbat, this is the, you know, Bet Knesset day. They walk into the synagogue. And this is very important, the synagogue, the person synagogue. And a lot of things happening there. A lot of people think that this is one of the key issue. If MK Orbach is walking to the Bet Knesset in Saturday Eve, and all the people over there tell him how big his mistake, so it might be any influence for the big story. But we will see, we will see.
And so it's up to Levin to decide today, and he's going to make that decision himself. He doesn't. Yeah. There's no law guiding him as to what
he have 1 week, 1 week maximum. He have to do it till next Monday because he will announce it today. So he will have a 1 week, and he can schedule it for every day during this week.
Okay, well, that will be something to keep our eyes on in the coming days. So if, and I know it's a big if, but if the Bennett-Lapid government does get off the ground, what will its immediate agenda look like, apart from maybe changing the locks on Balfour Street?
Surviving, that's all. That's all. I think that the first few days will be very important. The dynamic between Lapid and Bennett, it's going to be one of the most important things that we can ever checked about this upcoming or future government, because the dynamic will make the biggest influence about the question how long this government gonna survive. I think if it all works well, it might be even a long, I wouldn't say full-term government, but almost full. And we will see the dynamic between those two. But the first and the only mission and the first and the only agenda for the next few months, I will say, it's just to keep everything quiet, just to survive, to pass the, you know, the starting, and to make sure that it all works.
But with such a diverse coalition, leftists, rightists, centrists,
Arabs,
religious, Arabs, Islamists, I mean, can they keep everybody happy for long enough to make a difference?
They don't want to keep everyone happy. They want to keep everyone unsaid, okay? This is the only mission. No one will be happy, but they have to make sure that no one will be sad as well. This is the only mission.
The perfect compromise.
Yeah.
Michael, thank you so much for coming in. I hope you'll come back again soon.
Sure, definitely.
So guys, the front page of Haaretz today had a quote from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu about the greatest electoral fraud in the history of the known universe or something like that. I thought the Netanyahu era was over.
Sounds familiar, right? Greatest fraud ever. Yeah, I don't, where have I heard that before recently?
A few months ago, somewhere across the Atlantic, I think.
Yeah.
Is Bibi in denial, Anshul? Does he really think he can undo this evil edict, as they say in Hebrew?
Actually, it was interesting. He said, after he used that phrase, the greatest election fraud ever, he said, I have researchers who are checking, and I think this is the greatest fraud in any democracy ever. So maybe Donald Trump wouldn't be so happy to hear that there's an even bigger fraud than the one perpetrated against him in Arizona and Georgia and other parts of the United States. What was your question again?
Wouldn't you love to hear the two of them arguing over, you know, who is more of a martyr, you know, who's got a bigger conspiracy against them?
I kind of think that they don't speak anymore as much as they used to.
Maybe not.
They can't DM each other on Twitter, that's for sure. Is Netanyahu denying that all of this is going on? Is he just going to bury his head in the sand for a week, even at the cost of scorched earth, try and derail this government?
I don't think he's in denial. I think that he is, as he always does, he's trying every single option open to him until the very last minute. That's how he became the longest-serving prime minister, not by giving up, not relinquishing whatever opportunity he had. And he still has a few days, depending on when the confidence vote is held, and he'll keep on fighting until then. And from his perspective, why not? There's only a wafer-thin majority. If he manages to pick off one or two of the wavering Knesset members of the coalition, then they don't have a majority. And he remains prime minister for at least a few more months until an election. So Netanyahu is doing what you would expect him to do. The real issue with what Netanyahu is doing is not so much the fact that he's trying to survive, but the fact that he has basically allowed his proxies and his minions to use any kind of toxic language. And from words, sticks and stones break your bones, not words, but these words can lead to various actions. And that's the reason why we had this on Saturday night, the Shin Bet chief, Nadav Argaman, with really an unprecedented warning against the level of discourse.
It didn't seem to do much good, though. I mean, just yesterday, an elected Likud Knesset member compared the leaders of the two parties in the Change coalition to suicide bombers.
So Netanyahu, in short, I think what Anshul is telling us is he's in desperation, but he's not in denial. So in desperation, desperate times, desperate measures, all of that, right?
Extreme measures.
and I mean, we've mentioned Trump, unwillingly, I suppose. he is getting more Trumpian by the day. He's even copied Trump's tactic of not putting together a transition team. And you know, when he goes around comparing Israel's vaccination campaign to Pearl Harbor, as he did today, I mean, it sounds like he's losing it.
I wouldn't go that far. And also, you don't really need a transition team. In Israel, most of the civil servants, the officials, continue as before. It's not like in the United States where all the senior officials leave with one administration and come into the next one. You don't need a transition team. Assuming this new government is sworn in sometime this week or next Monday, from the moment they're sworn in, Naftali Bennett is the prime minister. The other ministers assume their positions in the next morning. There isn't that much protocol or certainly no big ceremonies in Israeli politics when a new government comes in. They'll go the next morning to a group photo at the president's residence and then immediately to their new ministries and take responsibility. With Naftali Bennett, there'll be things which will not be talked about. As soon as he's sworn in, he'll be taken to a room in the prime minister's office. The prime minister's military secretary will open a safe. Various files, of which we can only guess what are in them, will be put on a table. He'll have a long night of reading. Even Bennett, who's been in the security cabinet, who's been defense minister for a few months even, there are things that he doesn't know. Various files that, from what we know, to do with the strategic issues, relationships with the United States and other countries, things that we can only guess, or we can perhaps, even if we know, then we couldn't say. That's probably the most you get as a transition in Israel when a new prime minister comes in.
Mm. And the new coalition, or the hopefully new coalition, is doing their best to prepare the ground publicly to get ready for this transition. Yesterday, they had a very publicized photo op with a big picture of them all sitting around the table trying to ready the ground and make this coalition look as much as it can like a fait accompli, so that the country is ready for them when they come in.
Mm. But we are still putting the cart before the horse, right? Netanyahu still has a week. He is going to try and scupper this in any way possible, including the incitement that we heard over the last couple of days.
There is only one way you can scupper it. It's by denying this government for a majority. Mm. And we know who the wavering or supposedly wavering Knesset members are. They're being targeted by mobs and protesters and online smear campaigns.
At Netanyahu's behest.
So it would seem.
Well, didn't he tell his Likud faction into the politicians?
He did tell them to cancel Bohem, which we translated as lay into them. But it's been happening for days and days before he said that on Sunday afternoon to his Knesset faction. But it seems, from what I'm hearing, they're spent. They've tried, they're going to continue trying, but the necessary people or the main targets seem to be, if not happily at least, firmly in Bennett's camp. There could be a last minute surprise. The vote, whenever it takes place, the confidence vote, will be a roll call vote. So, we'll be listening for the names. And we know, luckily, Nir Orbach is in Aleph, so we'll know at the very beginning whether he's voting for or against. Until the government gets to their 61, nobody will breathe, or they'll be like everybody will be there on tenterhooks in the Knesset plenum. But we're getting there. There's a feeling, including within Likud and even in Netanyahu's circle, that it's a done deal, and Bibi will carry on fighting until the last moment,
and beyond, perhaps,
and certainly beyond. We can talk about what's going to happen after. But there's an acceptance that it's probably over for now.
If you want to be pessimistic and apocalyptic about it, and nobody could foresee what happened in the United States on January 6th, there is some sort of danger. I don't want to jinx anything, but some sort of last minute huge provocation which could cause another security incident / crisis that for some reason would forestall this new government coming in.
Mm. I mean, the planned flag march that was supposed to go through the Muslim quarter of Jerusalem, a procession of ultra-nationalists announced that they're cancelling it because they're not being allowed to march through the Muslim quarter. I think that says quite a lot about what their intentions were.
Absolutely.
To begin with. And Netanyahu hasn't been the only inciter in the past few days. And six leading religious Zionist rabbis issued a letter on Saturday calling on the public to do everything in their power not to allow the new government to materialise. That's quite a chilling throwback, no?
Yeah, but some of them went on television last night saying, oh, by saying that, we didn't mean violence and we renounce violence. So there's also a pushback, a pressure on them to verbally and explicitly renounce violence. We'll see if that helps.
Mm. How fitting is it that we're ending the Netanyahu era, if indeed we are, with another massive corruption scandal? It's like bookmarking his 12 years in...
Well, perhaps you should explain what we're talking about. There's a wave of arrests among both senior advisors of the former health minister, lobbyists and senior executives in at least one pharmaceutical company and also a big food company. And they all seem to have been somehow trying or succeeding to bribe the senior staff of the health ministry, the personal staff of the previous health minister, Yaakov Litzman, to get various drugs onto the subsidy list. Very huge thing for a pharmaceutical company. Mm. If your drugs, especially, we're talking here mainly about medications, which are needed only by a relatively small number of people, and therefore they're extremely expensive, out of the reach of almost any normal human being. Mm. And every other government is what's called the medication basket. Every other government decides to subsidize a number of these drugs, and to be on it is a huge boost for the balance sheet of any local pharmaceutical company. And it seems allegedly that some of them were trying to bribe the staff of Litzman. Now, Litzman is a UTJ Agudat Israel politician. His home newspaper is Hamodia. So one of the ways in which allegedly bribes were funneled with as ads in Hamodia. And there are other...
Along with generous donations to ultra-Orthodox charities with whom he's affiliated, sort of fits the model of the previous scandals with Aryeh Deri in Shas. It's a pattern.
And of course, Litzman himself, the Attorney General's already decided to indict him over various things he's done in relation to the Malka Leifer case and a couple of other things. So, like you say, this is a good, nice bookend for this government.
Mm. Can we set the cynicism aside for half a minute and talk about the broadness? It's a tall order, I know. Let's talk about the broadness of the coalition that's being formed. An alliance of three right-wing, two centrist, two left-wing parties, as well as an Arab-Islamic party, very conservative, and all coming together to oust Netanyahu. That's not nothing, right?
It's not nothing. It's definitely unity. If what you're looking for is unity from all sectors of Israeli society, you've got that, with the obvious exception of the ultra-Orthodox Haredi parties. It's a worthy effort. We'll see whether or not it can hold together. They all have a lot to lose. I think what's really holding this group together, not only that they all adamantly want Benjamin Netanyahu out of the prime minister's office, is none of them can really afford for this government to be a failure, because for a lot of them, it's most prominently Naftali Bennett, it's an all or nothing proposition. Either they succeed or they are really on the way to being wiped completely off the political map. So that's the best chance that we have in our corner, that they have so much riding on this that they need it to work.
You called it a broad coalition. The problem is, when we say broad coalitions in Israel, we usually mean that they've got 70 or 80 Knesset members, a workable majority. This is a very, very narrow coalition when it comes to its numbers.
It's numerically the smallest, it has
the smallest of majorities. Now, the range of ideologies and policy positions and constituencies that this coalition represents is indeed very broad. Alison just mentioned that the Haredi party, the Orthodox, are not there. There's also a type of secular Israeli who are not there. On the Arab sector, the Arabs who are represented are the Islamists. So you could say, you could almost say the Muslim or the Arab Haredim are there. But on the other hand, the secular Arab parties, Hadash and Balad and Ta'al, are not there. And that is a very interesting thing. Who would have expected? I mean, there has been talk for the last few years, certainly since Ayman Uda came, the leader of Hadash, and the joint list was formed in 2015, that there was this new atmosphere of trying to find a way of integrating Israeli Arab politics into the mainstream. Everybody thought Ayman Uda would probably be the man leading it, and he's such a popular figure amongst progressive Americans, and Jewish organizations would constantly fade him. Who would have believed that the man who would lead the first Arab-Israeli party into a coalition would be the leader of the Islamist party? While the other joint list parties, Hadash, Balad and Tal, are not exactly that pleased to see their rival who split with them in the last election. Suddenly he's the one potentially delivering the goods to the Arab community in the form of huge investments in infrastructure, freezing, perhaps cancelling tens of thousands of demolition orders for structures which were built without the permit. This is a huge test for Mansour Abbas. If he delivers, this is a potential revolution in Arab-Israeli politics, because we already saw in the election in March that a lot of the people who voted for Ra'am, now we're calling it in the paper United Arab List, for Abbas's party, were not necessarily Islamists. I went on election day to Tira, one of the main Arab-Israeli towns in the center of Israel, and I met quite a few people who told me they'd already voted or were planning to vote for him on that day. And I said, no, we're not Islamists. We just think this is something we need to try. We need to try and get into government, put aside the more ideological and Palestinian identity issues, try and make this work. If he makes this work, he's already technically the largest Arab party, because Hadash is only part of the joint list and it's three seats. He's got four. He could grow. Mm. Or if it doesn't work, if this government is short-lived, if Abbas doesn't deliver, then he could be wiped out. But this is a very big moment, and it's sort of like the mirror image or the negative of what's happening on the Jewish side with the Haredi parties, who are there always the ones who are used to being in coalitions and bringing the goods for their community. Now they're cast out into opposition. So you've got this interesting asymmetry between what's happening on the Jewish and on the Arab sides right now in this government. And if it gets sworn in, and if it lasts beyond a few weeks or a couple of months, but actually manages to pass its first budget and to last into the next year, who knows, even as far as the rotation in 2 years and 2 months, and Lapid becomes prime minister, so many interesting things could happen. And perhaps we'll start talking about politics in other aspects and not just the aspect of yes, Bibi, no, Bibi.
And what's super interesting about this, and Anshul, you've said this in the past, is that this could possibly be one of Benjamin Netanyahu's most lasting political legacies, as he is the first one to break down that barrier to seriously talk to Mansour Abbas about entering his coalition, putting a kosher stamp for the whole political establishment on bringing an Arab party or Arab parties into the coalition. And really, the existence of this partnership of the United Arab List with this current group is the fruit of Benjamin Netanyahu himself.
Mikhail told us earlier that the main goal of this new government will be survival. And already there's a date on which it could all fall apart. Angela, you mentioned the budget, and one of the clauses of the agreement is that if a budget isn't passed within 100 days, the government falls. Is this an escape hatch or built-in self-destruction mechanism?
I'm not 100% sure yet that clause will still be there when they put the coalition agreements on the table 24 hours, literally on the Knesset table, 24 hours before the confidence vote is to be held. But yes, whether that's going to be the actual clause, the budget is the big thing. If they pass the budget, and that will be their first order of business for the moment they get into office, then they have basically a year and a half in which, if they don't get it into massive fights, they can probably expect to keep this government running. And we're talking about the budget. We're talking about how Netanyahu is going to try and stop them even after they're sworn in as the new leader of the opposition. I think that we're looking at 2 or 3 months where we're going to start getting used to the fact that there is a government and Netanyahu is no longer the prime minister. Netanyahu is going to have to get used to the fact that he's leader of the opposition. And then once we're used to it, then perhaps first of all we'll realize actually Bibi didn't have to be the be-all and end-all of everything. So the coalition, the new coalition, will have to start work out what its policies are. But also Netanyahu, who by then will be 72. And leader of the opposition, not the kind of job he wanted back in the day perhaps, but not the kind of job he wants to be in at the age of 72. As a Knesset member, he can't have any other income. Now, Netanyahu he wants to travel. He'll have literally hundreds of offers for speaking engagements, six-figure speaking engagements. He's still got a massive fan base in the United States and other places around the world. He can't take those things as leader of opposition. And not only does he want to take those gigs and travel, and certainly his wife wants that that kind, you know, it won't be just the engagement. It'll be the travel, the first class tickets, the
dry cleaning.
Yeah. The hairdos,
and so
with
none of these things he'll be getting anymore because he won't be prime minister. There'll also be the legal bills. And those are going to start mounting. And the lawyers who until now have sort of been, okay, we're not going to start demanding the prime minister pay up now. They'll be less willing to wait around for Netanyahu to pay them. He's going to have a seven-figure in dollars, probably an eight-figure in shekels legal bill. This has already been going on for 3 or 4 years. It's going to go on for another couple of years. He's got a whole team of top-class lawyers. He's going to need money. He's going to need these speaking gigs. He's going to need a book deal. And I think the pivotal moment, once the budget is passed, if it's passed, and if it seems that this government's going to survive for more than just a couple of months, that's when Netanyahu will have the dilemma, do I stay in the Knesset? Now, he can sort of be in and out. He can leave the Knesset, and therefore he'll be able to make money outside. But he can remain leader of the Likud. There's no rule in the Likud rule book, as far as I'm aware, that he has to be a Knesset member to be leader of the Likud. But it is taking a step away from politics. And that, you know, that's the next big Bibi dilemma. It's down the road, but we should be aware that Netanyahu, as much as he's talking, and he ended his appearance yesterday, he said, even if we lose, even if they form this government, we will bring this government down very soon. He'll be a very bombastic and strong leader of the opposition for 2 or 3 months. I think after that time, he'll tire of that.
He should have grabbed the chance to be president while it was there.
I think he's regretting that already.
Yeah, they would have had a really nice house too. But this budget clause, in a way, it's a way to prevent Naftali Bennett from potentially doing to Lapid what Benjamin Netanyahu did to Benny Gantz. And so I think a lot of the question is, do they trust each other enough to not have to put this in writing, or should it just be there for you know, insurance purposes?
So and we've used the word "if" so many times on this episode that I think
it's an iffy week.
Assuming that we all survive this week and we get safely to the swearing-in of the next government, what's going to be weirder, not having Bibi as prime minister or having Naftali Bennett running the show?
Well, for we residents of Renana, it's going to be very weird to have Naftali Bennett as prime minister because, you know, he's the guy down the block, and we're going to have, you know, our sleepy suburb of Tel Aviv is going to turn into an armed camp with a lot of police around. We've already had a lot of protesters in front of Naftali Bennett's house. It hasn't been a lot of fun for the neighbors. So, neighborhood.
And he's staying. He's not moving to Jerusalem.
He's got 4 kids in 4 different schools. Yeah, he says
they're not
no
moving
way.
Into the residence.
Absolutely. So for where I stand, it's transformational. But I'm sure Anshel, who just wrote a
it's
really...
It's like living in, what's that place, Crawford, Texas, when George W. Bush opened the Western White House.
Yeah.
You're going to have the Ranana...
Absolutely.
They're running a Balfour.
Absolutely. Already they're going there for all kinds of negotiations, etc. But Naftali Bennett, you know, a generational change. It's going to be interesting if he can muster the kind of gravitas that we're used to seeing with the Israeli prime minister. But Anshel just did a deep dive into Bennett.
It feels like the start of a biography.
No, I don't think.
Everyone keeps saying that, right?
Has Bennett got what it takes to be a successful prime minister?
The problem is that we've sort of built our expectations of what an Israeli prime minister should look like around Netanyahu for so long. Now, let's get back to the real proportions of the job. Israel does not have a presidential system. It's a parliamentary system. The prime minister is the first among equals, but that's all he is. And yes, it is a sort of bizarre circumstance in which a leader of a small party is becoming prime. We haven't had that before, but there's nothing wrong with a leader of a small party from a constitutional point of view serving as prime minister. Any one of the 120 Knesset members can serve as prime minister. All they need is the confidence of the Knesset, and Bennett is assuming he receives that in the vote, he'll be the totally legal, totally legitimate prime minister. But it's a strange occurrence. It's never happened before. He'll be the 12th Israeli prime minister. All the previous prime ministers were either the leader of the largest or the second largest party. This is a new situation, and I think it's a good thing, you know, to put the prime minister's role, sort of cut it down back to size, he'll have to be a much more collegial. He is a much more collegial type than Netanyahu to begin with.
Everyone's a more collegial type than Netanyahu.
That's true. But Naftali Bennett, anybody who's worked with him, put his views and everything he's ever said to one side. Anybody who's worked with him, for the exception of Netanyahu, has enjoyed working with him. And you know, people only have good things to say about just how it is to be in his office.
His American parents taught him manners.
That as well. And his Israeli wife was, I think, also a good influence on him. But he will have to be collegial because his partners are leaders of larger parties than his or equal size. Only Mansour Abbas is a smaller party right now than Yamina. Yamina has already lost one of its Knesset members, Amichai Shikli, who's defected. It'll be a much more consensual type of cabinet. And the Prime Minister doesn't have to be this bigger than life magician, ultra mega statesman that Netanyahu has been. Yeah. Someone said the CEO of Pfizer will be able to sleep again.
Oh, there he goes. He won't be harassing him with the phone calls. But you know, just to point out that you know, with his tiny little 6-seat constituency, when times get tough, he won't have this big party to rally around him, to support him, to defend him when he's under attack. And generally, that's been very helpful for Israeli prime ministers who have, you know, 25, 30 seats behind them in the Knesset to offer them support. And you have to remember the only, I guess, previous example we have of that, Ehud Olmert, when things got rough and he had the Kadima party, which was not this sort of established historic party with the great constituency and roots. He couldn't fight anything out. He didn't have enough people to support him. Things better go fairly smoothly for Bennett, because I think that the first really rocky period, he could you know, get ousted pretty quickly.
Until now, Lapid was the one who had to tempt Bennett into the coalition, because Bennett's party were the votes they needed for the majority. So that's why Bennett's going to be prime minister. The moment he becomes prime minister, suddenly he has what to lose. From the moment Naftali Bennett is sworn in as the most powerful man in Israel, actually, he becomes less powerful within his own cabinet and coalition, because suddenly he's a prime minister and he has what to lose. But until that moment...
Yet another paradox of Israeli politics.
And if you look at the polls now, it's Lapid who's really challenging Netanyahu. When people are asked, who do you think would be the best prime minister for Israel? Lapid is now getting within 4 or 5 points of Bibi, and Bennett is not even in the race. But just because of the weird configuration of this government, he's the guy who's going to sit at the top and not Lapid. I think if you ask a lot of people on the street, they think that Lapid has earned it more than Bennett has.
Mm. Alison, amongst all of this political drama, we've never actually gotten around to discussing the fact that Israel has a new president. Prime Minister, Isaac Bougie Herzog. Somebody pointed out on Twitter that Israel and the United States now both have presidents of Irish descent.
There you go.
any other similarities spring to mind?
I think that they're both pretty mild-mannered guys, although I think probably you would say that Biden has more political steel at the core than Bougie Herzog did, as we can't forget that he was not a success as a mainstream electoral politician. You know, he's marked by his loss in 2015. But you know that they're centrists, they're compromise guys, they're people. It's more significant in Biden's case, obviously, than in Herzog's, because in the president's mansion, you have less actual power to wield. Yeah, I guess their personas are similar, though. Yeah. Obviously, they're very very different in age. Although Biden is, you know, from the working class, and Herzog is anything but coming from this sort of long Israeli-style aristocracy of chief rabbis and presidents and et cetera. Mm.
Do you think his natural inclination would maybe to be more of an outward-looking president in terms of healing the rifts with certain diaspora communities?
Well, yeah, he's certainly going to try. I actually spoke recently for an upcoming article to Rick Jacobs, the head of the Reform Movement, and he was very excited. He sort of spoke about how Reuven Rivlin started his term as completely unsympathetic and unfriendly, frankly, to liberal diaspora communities, especially in North America, and how he turned the corner. And he said, and look at now we've got Bougie Herzog, who's, you know, already coming in, you know, at 30. third base and he can take it the extra step and heal the rifts. But frankly, I think that the thing that's going to do the most for the Israel diaspora relationship will be, forever long it lasts, Israeli government without the ultra orthodox in the coalition, who will give the sitting prime minister, you know, that kind of space and that kind of room to make actual public gestures towards non-orthodox movements.
There are plenty of Haredim living in the diaspora as well. We shouldn't think the diaspora is just nice secular people like you and Simon. There are lots of Haredim in the diaspora, and there are going to be a lot more of them. So
true, but I don't
think we should stop thinking that Israel needs to have a secular government for the diaspora to like us. There is not one diaspora. There are many Jewish diasporas,
right.
And probably if you look at American Jewry today, the Haredi, no question, the Haredi community is the fastest growing there.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, first of all, Naftali Bennett is going to be our first Orthodox prime minister, so I don't think he's going to have that much trouble reaching out to Orthodox communities in the diaspora. But I'm talking about on a political level. I'm talking about the issues that these large diaspora constituencies, I'm talking, you know, largely North America, care about. And Netanyahu, in order to keep his rock-solid political alliance brotherhood with the ultra-Orthodox, really had to step back from making any concessions in their favor. And so, therefore, the leadership, president, prime minister, etc., won't have their hands tied, at least for now.
One final question. Do we know whether the incoming president has reached out to Seth Rogen yet?
We'll see. You know, those are peace negotiations that have to be made. Yes, you know, they accused each other of misrepresenting the truth in the interview that I did a couple of years ago, and I tweeted to Seth Rogen to see what he thought of Herzog's election, and he has not yet responded.
Well, we wait with bated breath.
Have you asked his mother though?
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Guys, I'm afraid we're out of time for this episode. My thanks to Michael Hauser-Tov, Alison Kaplan-Summer, Anshul Pfeffer, and our producer, Aaron Ehrlich. Don't forget to tune in on Friday, listeners, for the first episode of Haaretz Weekend. Until then, shalom from Tel Aviv.